This show is sponsored by Liquid IV. When I'm near the end of writing any big article, I often feel excited about finishing it and getting it out into the world. But over the years, I've learned to pace myself in a way that works for me. If I step away from the draft and come back to it with fresh eyes the next day, I'll almost always find ways to improve it. Now let's apply that idea in another way. Rehydrate in a way that works for you with Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier, which has 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, 8 vitamins and nutrients in every stick, and comes in all kinds of flavors. Passion fruit, tropical punch, strawberry, the list goes on. I'm a lemon-lime guy myself. Whether you've just finished a workout or traveling, or maybe you just have a long day ahead, Liquid IV can help you recharge or prepare for what's coming your way. And it's super easy. You just tear the packet open, pour it in your water, mix it up, and that's it. If you're like me and you sit in front of a screen all day and then you watch a bunch of movies and TV at night, we could all probably benefit from drinking more water. But just 1 stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water actually hydrates better than water alone. Rehydrate with better hydration from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code FILMWEEKLY at liquidiv.com. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's 2026. We made it. The new year doesn't require a whole new you, but wouldn't it be nice to feel a little less weighed down? Therapy can help more easily identify all the things that might be holding you back from reaching your goals or being your ideal self. We all have obstacles to overcome. Personally, I'm working on trying not to hold grudges. That's a big one for me. I hang on to grudges sometimes for years, and I know that's probably not the best way to move through life. BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms. With over 30,000 fully licensed therapists who have served more than 5 million people around the world, it really works. And it has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com. Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions of dollars by pulling your personal data off the internet and selling it without your consent. Data brokers are selling your name, address, phone number, and more to marketers, scammers, basically anyone who's willing to pay for it. But Aura helps you fight back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off, and they alert you quickly if your information shows up in some kind of breach. But Aura is more than just data broker removal. In one simple app, Aura gives you a full digital security suite, including a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers before they can reach you. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. And if your identity does ever get stolen, you're backed by up to $5 million in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support to help you recover quickly. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That is enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove to get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, January 14th, 2026. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll chat about Is This Thing On? We'll discuss Primal Season 3 and present an interview with Genndy Tartakovsky. And we'll also present an interview with Sam Haft, one of the people behind the music of Has Been Hotel. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com. It's just me for the news segment here. Just wanted to recap a few things that have happened since we talked about the news, which has been a little while. The Lowdown Season 2 is officially happening at FX, which is amazing news. If you have not seen Season 1 of The Lowdown, it's streaming on Hulu right now. It's the Ethan Hawke detective show from Sterling Harjo, who's the creator of Reservation Dogs. The Lowdown Season 1 was absolutely one of my favorite shows of last year, so I am very excited to see what that story looks like as it progresses into another season. Speaking of multiple seasons of acclaimed shows, Kate Winslet has said that there is a strong likelihood that she'll be shooting Mare of Easttown Season 2 in 2027. And I think this is the first indication that we've gotten that this is actually going to happen. Well, I say actually going to happen. I mean, she thinks that it might happen right now, and 2027 is still kind of a long way away. So we'll see. Anything could happen in between now and then. But it certainly seems like she's going to be reteaming with Brad Inglesby, who's the creator of Mayor of Easttown. I'm a little bit more mixed about this one because the first season of that show was so great as it was, and I'm not sure about continuing that particular story. Everything felt really nice and neat and wrapped up, and while I love Kate Winslet and thought she was great in that role, I mean, I guess I'm down for more adventures with this character and maybe her solving another crime or something. But season one was so wrapped up in her own interpersonal dramas and traumas and histories and relationships with like the people that were specifically involved in this case that she was investigating. So what do you do for a second season? You can't really have her retrace those same steps. So does she go to a different city and solve another crime or something? I mean, again, I trust the people behind this show, but from the outside looking in, it just kind of doesn't seem like it has that same longevity immediately and obviously baked into it. So we'll see if that ends up coming to pass. Sydney Sweeney is going to be starring in a new Housemaid movie. The Housemaid came out at the very end of last year and has made a ton of money. I think it's over $200 million at this point, and it's just a huge, huge hit right now. Paul Feig is coming back to direct it. Sydney Sweeney is coming back to star in it. The downside to this is Amanda Seyfried is not coming back because her character, Nina Winchester, does not appear in the sequel book, The Housemaid's Secret, that was also written by Freda McFadden, who has written a whole series of housemaid related novels. So I'm not really sure. I'm not going to spoil what happens in The Housemaid here, but I will say that the direction they seem to be setting it up to go in, I'm not entirely sold on watching Sydney Sweeney do that. Maybe the rest of the world is. Obviously, the rest of the world liked what happened in this first movie, or at least was interested enough to check it out. So we'll see if that particular sort of shift in formula is enough to keep this franchise afloat. Next up, I wanted to mention that Sebastian Stan has been recruited to play, I believe, Harvey Dent in The Batman Part Two, which is Matt Reeves' follow-up to The Batman from several years ago. We also know, and I don't think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but this was reported a while ago, that Scarlett Johansson is joining the ensemble in an undisclosed role. But I believe it was the Hollywood Reporter in their Heat Vision newsletter who confirmed the rumors that Sebastian Stan will be playing Harvey Dent, aka Two-Face, in this new movie. So intriguing, a jump from Marvel to DC, yet another one. And yeah, two Avengers reuniting over in James Gunn's DC Universe in one of the most anticipated movies in quite some time, for me anyway. I'm really looking forward to The Batman Part Two. That is scheduled to hit theaters on October 1st, 2027. So we still have a little ways to go on that. Next up, Lucasfilm seemingly has found its replacements for Kathleen Kennedy as the head of the company. So she has been the president of Lucasfilm ever since Disney bought Lucasfilm in 2012. And reports came out last year that she would be stepping down from that role. And now it appears, according to a new report in Puck, that two people are going to be taking over her job. One of them is Dave Filoni, who is the current chief creative officer of Lucasfilm and one of the big minds behind The Mandalorian and Ahsoka and Star Wars Rebels. And he will be joined, if this report is correct, by Lynwyn Brennan, who is a behind-the-scenes executive who is currently serving as the president and general manager of Lucasfilm business. So it sort of seems like a DC Universe type of situation, DC Studios type of situation, where James Gunn runs the creative side and Peter Safran, who is also a producer, runs the sort of day-to-day business stuff. And it seems like that kind of split will be applied over here as well. To me, this seems like pretty bad news. Not that things have gone great under Kathleen Kennedy, especially in the last few years, but the fact that Dave Filoni is being given even more power seems completely opposite of what I would personally like to see from the Star Wars universe. I know a lot of people are on board with what he's doing over there, so I'm sure this is going to be a divisive appointment if it actually goes through. But Filoni is one of those guys who just seems to me to have burrowed deeper and deeper into the lore of Star Wars, which is not something that I personally care about. Again, I know a lot of people do. So we'll see how this all shakes out, I guess. I mean, this just kind of feels like Andor might have been the last gasp of Star Wars for me, basically. So I hope that's not true. I think there's a lot of potential there. But if we keep getting stuff like the Book of Boba Fett and Ahsoka and stuff like that, because it scratches these creative itches that Dave Filoni has, I don't know how much more I'm going to be caring or paying attention to what's happening in Star Wars. So it could be fine that they're deciding to leave people like me behind. God knows not everything has to be directly aimed at me, but yeah, this direction in leadership just does not exactly strike me as the best move for the company. But again, what do I know? So we have an article called Five Changes That Star Wars Needs Under Lucasfilm's New Leadership. I will link to that in the show notes. It was written by Ryan Scott, who pays much more attention to the goings-on in the Star Wars universe than I do. I also wanted to mention just really quick, there's some casting news for Disney's live-action adaptation of Tangled, and this was really fascinating because Sarah Catherine Hook, who played one of the daughters in The White Lotus Season 3, said that she was honored to be in the conversation for the role of Rapunzel in the live-action Tangled, and The Hollywood Reporter wrote an article about this and published it on January 7th at 11:12 a.m. And it seems like kind of a fluffy quote, and it seems like there's no way that THR would actually publish that article unless they knew something that everybody else didn't, which a lot of people thought Sarah Catherine Hook might actually be a lock to play that role. And it certainly seems, reading between the lines here, that Hollywood Reporter thought the same thing, because they published this kind of fluffy quote of her just being like, oh yeah, I'd love to do it or whatever. Oh my gosh, it would mean the whole wide world, she said. I mean, who doesn't want to be a Disney princess? And so they wrote this whole article about it. And then I want to say it was 2 hours later, 1 p.m. that same day, the same website, the Hollywood Reporter, published an exclusive piece saying that Tegan Croft has actually been cast in that role, and somebody named Milo Manheim has been cast as Flynn Rider in the movie. So it was just one of the only examples I can think of, one of the only times that this has ever happened in a trade reporter, at least as long as I've been paying attention since 2005 or so, where a trade would publish a story like that, that certainly seems like they're leaning one way, and then within a couple hours, completely change direction. So I'm not sure what happened behind the scenes here, if the truth of this is ever fully going to come out, but it certainly seems like she was so close to signing on the dotted line and something just fell apart at the very last possible second. And then Tegan Croft kind of swooped in and got that role anyway. So I don't even really, to be completely frank, know who Tegan Croft is. I don't know who Milo Manheim is. I really enjoyed the animated Tangled movie. I caught up with that many, many years after it came out because I had not really heard great things about it, but it is incredibly underrated in my view. Again, I'm not really thrilled about Disney doing these live action remakes. I feel like they're all creatively bankrupt, but whatever, that's what's happening. So just a little bit of the casting news there I thought was kind of notable. And then also a couple days later, Variety reported that Catherine Hahn is in talks to star as Mother Gothel, or Gothel. I don't remember actually how you pronounce this character's name. I'm sorry. She's the antagonist of this story. And that really seems like perfect casting. Scarlett Johansson was previously in talks to play that part, and that just seemed all wrong to me. Like, I appreciate ScarJo as an actress, but I just don't know if she had the kind of like theatricality that character needs. And Catherine Hahn, she walks into a room and you know that she has that kind of mode to her. So I think she's going to be able to play this role in her sleep. So that is all the casting news and movie and TV news we have for you right now. Let's go ahead and jump into my conversation with Brad about Is This Thing On? With me now to talk about Is This Thing On is Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, Brad, you are the person that I'm so curious to hear your reaction to this movie, because it's a film about stand-up comedy, and you don't often see that in the modern Hollywood landscape, or really Hollywood history. I mean, you could probably count on one hand the number of movies that are kind of about stand-up, right? Like, this is just a pretty rare thing, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, they don't really come around very often. I would say maybe the last one that was probably had the most prominence is The Big Sick, and that's not even technically about stand-up comedy, but Kumail Nanjiani's character, you know, is an aspiring, rising stand-up comedian. It's more typically found on TV shows, for sure. There's a lot more TV shows that focus on real comedians who are also playing a version of themselves as stand-up comedians. So yeah, it's pretty rare in the big screen landscape.
And I guess I don't want to mischaracterize this movie, because even though the trailers are kind of selling the stand-up component as maybe the most interesting thing about it, I don't know if I would fully say that this is a movie that's really about stand-up comedy. It's more of just like a family drama that happens to have one character pursuing stand-up as a sort of a creative outlet, right?
Yeah, you know, and like it's really not much different than like what has happened with people who have found a career in stand-up comedy. You know, there's some of them, you know, do it because they become obsessed with it because of seeing certain stand-up comedy special, things like that. Other people get into it, you know, after some kind of life event that drives them to it because they suddenly have something to talk about that they view with a funny perspective and put an interesting spin on it. So yeah, it's definitely not strictly about stand-up comedy. It's not focused on someone trying to become a stand-up comedian. It just happens to be part of kind of their coping mechanism for how they're dealing, you know, with a divorce.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get into sort of the dramatic aspects of the movie in a minute, but the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is because I know that you have pursued stand-up on occasion. You've done some stand-up comedy yourself, and so I was wondering what you thought about the comedy in this movie and if it seemed true to your real life experience.
Yeah, 100%. You know, this is a bit of a different experience because he does it like right in the heart of New York, and you know, it's the Comedy Cellar, which is like you really have to like put in time to like make a dent there. They have open mics and stuff like that. But you know, the way Bradley Cooper captures the experience of starting stand up and the way he uses such an intimate POV, like he puts the camera right in Will Arnett's face the first time that his character Alex does stand up, and you really feel the heat of him being on stage for the first time, almost like you're on stage with him. And that for me, as you know, someone who went through the process of getting on stage at an open mic for the first time and like being nervous about getting laughs and like the relief you feel when you get your first laugh and it starts to go well, and just the gradual comfort there is and how you start writing everything down, you know, whether it's on your phone or on little scraps of paper or a notebook or something like that. This really did capture just the life of like being a comedian and like starting to let it like be a big part of your life and using stuff in your real life to inspire your jokes, and the awkwardness that can come when people realize that you're talking about them in your stand-up bits, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They capture Bradley Cooper captures incredibly well.
Yeah. So what did you think about the movie overall? Like, not just the comedic aspects, but just as a piece of art, what did you think about this one?
You know, I really like it. It's on one level, it's fairly standard kind of like relationship drama stuff. But I also like these kinds of stories. I like stories about relationships that are troubled and two people who are kind of struggling to find their way back to each other when they're both at a point in their life when they're feeling kind of unhappy and unsure what to do. I like the idea of like this spark coming back when Will Arnett's character starts to like have a new sense of confidence and purpose about himself because he's finding success in stand-up comedy. And I like the approach to their relationship and how it evolves in the wake of their divorce. So it's to me, this it felt like the kind of movie that like I would have like loved, you know, when seeing it like at Sundance or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It has very much has Sundance vibes to it. So I came away liking it a lot, and especially the ending I absolutely love too. I won't spoil, you know, exactly what happens, but yeah, this is a movie that I found myself feeling very proud of Will Arnett, just because I feel like this is like a really big breakthrough performance for him. It shows a completely different side of him than we've seen before. And I know something like BoJack Horseman like also had these dramatic elements to it and kind of had a tinge of a similar approach as far as the characterization, but like that's a voice role, and even though it does require a definitely an immense amount of talent, a different kind of talent, seeing him as this character in a live action role And having, especially like I said, with Bradley Cooper focusing, you know, really getting intimate and like focusing so much on his face during key sequences and things like that, I was just like, wow, man, like this is like such a great role for him.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think about Will Arnett as potentially a Bradley Cooper stand-in type of figure, like in a meta narrative type of way, because this is Bradley Cooper's third feature, I think. And A Star is Born is this big operatic movie. It's obviously a remake. It's been told, that story's been told several times before. Maestro is like this incredibly heightened, almost like pompous type of movie. And I just did not think that Bradley Cooper had this type of film in him. I was so pleasantly surprised by this because it felt like a normal movie, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean? Like when you're talking about Bradley Cooper, he has this kind of like larger than life persona that he's crafted as an artiste almost, you know? And like, it just felt like his career was going in a certain type of direction. And this movie feels like such a hard pivot away from whatever that kind of like almost getting lost in his own sauce type of vibe that he was cultivating there. And this just feels like a really welcome story at this point in his career, where it is just about these two people, and there's not like a super high concept or anything, and it's not like super stylized or heightened filmmaking or anything that feels like he's trying to show off as a director or really like prove anything to anyone. And I really just appreciated the way that the film felt comfortable with itself and kind of settled in, and like you just are along for the ride, and it's just, it feels like a throwback movie in that way. Like we say this phrase all the time that people just don't really make movies like this anymore, but this really feels like a character study out of the 70s, 80s, 90s era. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'm honestly kind of surprised that Bradley Cooper didn't take this lead role for himself, because like you mentioned, you know, both A Star is Born and Maestro, he starred in both of those movies in addition to directing them. And this, in a way, it does feel like Bradley Cooper could have easily played this character, because Will Arnett isn't super far removed from Bradley Cooper's overall persona, you know, especially in this movie. Like you can really see that. So I wonder what it was that made him want to put Will Arnett in this role as opposed to taking it on himself, because Bradley Cooper can be very funny, and I think that he would have been great in this role. But at the same time, it was very refreshing to see him in such a goofy supporting role as just kind of this douche nozzle aspiring actor who goes by the name Balls. And just, he's so funny in this movie, and he's such a goober too.
Yeah, it's such an interesting decision, like thinking about the Bradley Cooper project, you know, watching him really kind of carve his way into the Hollywood pantheon. He's been nominated for so many Oscars now, not only for acting and writing and directing, but like as a producer, and he has really felt like he's been this guy who's just been really been kind of clawing for respectability. And again, for him to make that decision to play this character who is a total like a douche, and like he's just so goofy and out there, and he just feels like he's high for half the film, if not more than that. And he's just like, the idea that he would be self-aware enough to realize that it would be effective for him to take on that type of role and kind of let the air out of the balloon a little bit for what people are, people like me are reading into his career, I just think was a really, really smart move on his part. So yeah, is there anything else about this movie that stood out to you? I mean, we haven't mentioned the name Laura Dern yet, and she is great in this. That idea of like knowing someone for one thing and that person not really agreeing with that one thing being their defining characteristic, I thought was really well executed here. And that's like a thing that I've experienced in my own life, and I know people who have felt that way. And so I thought that was like a really, really exceptionally well observed piece of this story. But anything else you wanted to highlight here?
Yeah, you know, I really love her story, and that like she's not they don't make her character like this curmudgeonly, you know, shrill female character who's just complaining about her husband. You know, she also has her own demons that she's working through, and the way that her character and Will Arnett's character kind of like work through things and talk through stuff is, it's a very realistic and grounded approach to it. You know, you don't it's not often that you see movies about divorce play out like this, and where it's not overly dramatic, like something like a Marriage Story, and it's not just like the comedy that comes from divorce and dealing with that kind of thing. It's somewhere in the middle, and there's a real nice authenticity to the way that they work through stuff and the way that they see each other, and just the approach about how the dynamic between two people evolves when they've been married for so long, and how you can become complacent with a relationship and you need something drastic can happen to kind of reshape that. And, you know, it could potentially, you know, reignite something in your relationship, or it could be the thing that makes you realize, oh, maybe we're not supposed to be together anymore. It's just a really fascinating, you know, kind of relationship drama in that way because of how real it is.
Yeah. Anybody who is complaining that there aren't very many movies for adults out there, go see Is This Thing On? Because I think it fits the bill for that description. All right, Brad, joining us now is Slash Film staff writer Rafael Motomayor.
Hi, everybody.
Rafael, I'm bringing you on because you've seen Primal Season 3, and Brad has seen it as well. I have not seen any of this show yet. Actually, I think I watched the pilot episode and was impressed by it, but I just didn't make the time to keep up with the show. But I wanted to kind of create a space for you two to talk about Primal Season 3. So, Rafael, since I just brought you on, I'll ask you first, what did you think about this season compared to previous seasons?
I think it's stellar. I think each season of the show has been fantastic. I think what makes this one stand out is just how much emotion is in it and how much it deepens the characters that we already grown to know over the previous 20 episodes. It's a more focused season. It's a more self-contained in terms of scope. It happens within a smaller sort of location compared to the last season, and yet we go into the world building and into the characters more deeply than we have before.
Okay. Brad, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I love this season. I'm really glad that Gendy decided to return to Fang and Spear, since he was originally planning on turning this into an anthology series that was going to follow an entirely new story and set of characters based on what happens at the end of season two, which, I won't say it, even though everyone else will have known by now, but I feel like I don't want to spoil it for Ben, you know?
Okay, I appreciate it.
I mean, I think once we talk about though what kind of happens with the beginning of season three, you'll know what happens at the end of season two. So maybe it won't be as big of a, you know, a spoiler, but I talked to Gendy about that in an interview. Gendy Tartakovsky, who's the creator of the show and previously worked on Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack. But I really like this season. Yeah. Like Rafael said, because of how it taps back into these characters and it takes us on a different kind of emotional journey. And it also expands the emotional dynamic and journey between one of the newer characters who came along in the second season and was a big part of the story. So on top of that, also, even though it is still a very emotional journey, I actually think that this is one of the funniest season two because of the story turn that happens with Spear from the get-go. There's a lot of really good comedy, and of course that's accompanied by the incredible visuals and like the graphic violence and some of the wild like supernatural turns that exist in this this cool prehistoric world. So yeah, this is just a really cool season.
Well, speaking of the visuals, Rafael, I wanted to ask you about that because I know you're a huge fan of animation of all kinds. And what do you think about the look of this show and maybe the evolution of Tartakovsky and his animation across his career?
So I think this is the best show Tartakovsky has made, not just story-wise, but visual-wise. He's talked in the past about how the working dynamic with a French studio, Lacachette, who makes this show, has been the best working relationship he's had, where the communication between his storyboards and the animators taking that on and making animation has been the most clear. And you can tell with the final product that his vision is fully realized here. And he's really unleashing every aspect of storytelling he's been honing for the past 30 plus years. As Brad said, like with the violence and the emotion, but also the comedy, you see the evolution of everything he's worked on since Dexter's Lab, through Samurai Jack, the use of silence and just pure visual storytelling is on full display in this show. And one thing that I particularly liked about season three is the focus on character acting, on because there's no dialogue in the show, all the emotions, all the dialogue is told through facial expressions and body language. And with the big change that the main character Spear goes through at the start of the season, we get to see a new side of him, and the way the animators convey his story through motion and expression is just breathtaking, really.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about the series overall is, you know, if there's anybody listening who hasn't watched Primal like Ben, it is a dialogue-free series for the most part. There's a very tiny, minuscule bit of dialogue that ends up coming into the show, but it is largely driven by the visuals, and it's a show that you really have to pay attention to and watch because of how much is conveyed through, you know, the body language and facial expressions of these animated characters. And it's incredible how much they're able to do without dialogue, and that's really a big part of what makes it such a beautiful story too.
So I'm not sure about the rollout for this season. I should have looked this up. I apologize. But do you guys know if they're dropping the whole season at once? Is it a weekly thing, or how much is out there?
Weekly.
Okay. All right. So is it, I'm guessing it's just one episode that people will have the opportunity to see of season three by the time we release this. You think that's right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like it's one per week. Yeah.
Okay. So is there anything from that premiere episode that you guys remember that stood out to you that you can talk about here? I mean, don't spoil anything beyond that for folks who are watching along in real time, but is there anything that you guys can recall from that first episode?
The biggest thing, we're technically allowed to talk about the details now since the episode is out, but at the end of season two, Spear dies heroically in battle. And so you'd think that would be the end of the story, but through a turn of events and through, we'll say some kind of like witchcraft, sorcery, what have you, Spear is brought back to life and is essentially a zombie. But he's not a zombie that remembers everything or knows really who he is or what's happening or anything like that. But he's still very strong and has this kind of like innate, you know, instinct to survive and defend himself and whatnot. And so most of the season is him trudging along and like living and occasionally having these flashes of who he is and like kind of in a brain dead way starting to like figure things out.
Raphael, that's plot development sounds like something that maybe in another show would be emotionally manipulative to the point of frustration almost, of like, wait a second, now you're telling me that this big, potentially major event that happened at the end of one season is just being dramatically undone. But what Brad said there makes it seem like maybe that's not the case for this season because it's not exactly the same character. I mean, it is the same person, but it's not like the show just kind of hand waved that away. It kind of changes the dynamic a little bit. Did you feel that when you're watching it?
Yeah, that's what a big part of why I love this season so much is that it takes what could have easily been just a cop out and instead turns it into an opportunity to rediscover who Spear is, because a big part of the show is just, as Brad said, he gets these sort of flashes to his previous life. And he spends most of the season just like learning about the world, and we sort of are experiencing the show for the first time again through his eyes as he learns about everything while at the same time trying to sort of rediscover who he is and whether he can go back to being the Spear that we knew. So it both continues the story from the previous season while also sort of making him a new character in a way that keeps being the same show while still being like quite fresh, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see how they managed to do that without being at any point sort of going against the rules of the show, if there is any.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like the kind of thing that they do like in, you know, comic book movies or shows where all of a sudden a character is just back from the dead. You know, there's an actual significance and emotional meaning, you know, behind his return. And like, it's not just as simple as him being back to life. And what's great at is, on top of that, this is where a lot of the comedy comes from too. And there's so many times when you'll get a camera cut to just like, a dead-eyed, open-mouthed Spear, like looking like a zombie, like just trying to figure things out. And it's like when something has happened, and just the cut to his expressionless, like clueless face is hilarious.
All right. Well, is there anything else either one of you want to say about the show before we jump to Brad's interview?
It's just one of the best animated shows out there. One of the best shows out there in general. Not even, you know, with the caveat of being animated. Like, it's just, it's incredible work all around. And I love that it exists.
Yeah, it truly feels special that, again, after 30 plus years, it feels that Tartakovsky is still just getting started in terms of showing new things. And I'll just say that this season is both, I think, the most violent and also the most family focus in some ways. There's some very interesting comedy, like family themed comedy in this season, which is hilarious to see.
Awesome. All right. Well, here is Brad's conversation with Genndy Tartakovsky.
I love the new season of Primal. It's fantastic. Every episode, I have a moment to myself where I just go, this show absolutely rules.
That's awesome.
So, your original plan for Primal after the end of season two was to turn the show into an anthology series and follow new characters with a different story. Can you detail some of those options that you considered and how far into developing them you got before you decided to go back to Spear and Fang?
Sure. Well, yeah. The first stuff that I started to do was based on kind of creation in a way. So I wanted like this orange looking furry female creature and this blue malish creature, and they look humanoid, but they've got fur and other things that make them look, you know, for lack of a better word, alien. And yeah, then they meet, and so you do love and different language, you know, no dialogue, of course, right? And them surviving this horrific world with crazy creatures, and everything is made up, right? So that was the new thing, where Primal is everything based on reality for the most part. This is pure fantasy.
Right.
And so I'm like, all right, I kind of like it, right? And then every idea that I had for it felt repetitive from what we did in the first season.
Gotcha.
Right? So they meet this creature and they learn this thing, or they meet this little creature, which is really mean. You know what I mean? Like it all becomes, so it felt very unfresh.
Gotcha.
And so then I was like, well, maybe this isn't the right idea. And I started thinking about other ones and like something set maybe in World War I, right? And then it was like, well, where's that one was missing the pulp aspect of it, right? Anyways, and then the biggest realization was kind of like, well, you know, it takes me about 2 years to make a season.
Right.
Hopefully. And so I lived with it for 2 years, hardcore, like intense. And then when we put it out there, you live with it for a week, maybe, you know, a few weeks. And then you want more. And it's very fresh. And you enjoyed watching it. And it's a fun experience. And I'm like, oh, shit, I screwed it up. Like, I mistook the audience's perception as my perception.
Yeah.
You know, even though I love it and I love making it, it's still 2 years of investment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, so when a little time passed, I realized, like, what did I just do? I spent 20 episodes working so hard to introduce this relationship and these characters for the audience to like them. Then I kill off the main character and then I end it. Right. And so I go, well, now what? So if I wanted to do more, what am I going to do? I don't want to do a prequel. I don't want to do, like, you know, And then I think as a joke, I go, "Oh, well, he'll be a zombie now." And I was like, "Wait, hold on a second." And it felt really good in my gut, and the instinct of it was right. And then I wrote down 10 ideas of what would happen, right? And the idea that he's not who he is, but then little flashes, almost like, Born Identity or something, starts coming in, and then him getting his humanity back through death sealed it. Right. And especially like when that cricket episode, the third one,
Yeah, so good.
when we started doing that and it had all that emotion and the horror and the action and everything, it was like, this feels so right.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you were able to find that way into it because it makes for another interesting story that taps into the emotion of the characters, like connecting again and then, but also still evolving Spear as a character, especially once he starts to, once he realizes he's like a father now too.
So it started to build on that emotion exactly, and the hope was like, oh, you guys know this character already, so now he's something else. And I was hoping, oh, I hope the audience cheers for him to get back to who he is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so that was the biggest, hope is that,
Yeah.
you're gonna root for him.
Let's talk about the development of Zombie Spear. Did his design change as the season developed, and how did you determine the injuries he would sustain and how they would alter his appearance as the episodes went on?
Well, we definitely wanted, I wanted it to be more than what we had. The skeletal hand was just like a doodle that I did that looked like a skeleton hand. I was like, yes, that's so cool to do a skeleton hand. And then the chopped off brain, I was excited about. And everything else were just kind of scars and scratches, right? And also, like, one thought, maybe for the other question, was also, I haven't really watched the zombie movie where the zombies are the heroes, right? It was they were always the threat, and now we get to cheer for a zombie as the hero. Was like a really, I thought, unique thought. It's like, oh yeah, that's really cool. You're kind of cheering for the bad guy in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah,
I think.
so the design. Sorry, so the design kind of, it wasn't there wasn't that much exploration because we know where we're starting from. And it was more about, well, how is he going to stand now? How is he going to walk? How much do we push him? And then it kind of informed itself in a way.
Now, I think this might also be the funniest season of Primal, largely thanks to Zombie Spear and how everyone reacts to him and how, like, he perceives the world and trying to figure it out. Can you talk about injecting that whole new layer of comedy into the show?
That's funny you say that. Yeah, I mean it's a lot of times, honestly, through everything that I do, I'm trying to hold myself back because I do like doing humor, through Dexter and Powerpuff
Yeah, of
and even in
course.
Jack and Fixed, of course, and everything. So there's always that element, and so I never want to break my own wall, like tonally. You still want the horror to feel horror, and you don't want it to be like Army of Darkness all of a sudden where everything is a joke. Even though I love it, but not for,
Yeah, of
not
course.
for this. So yeah, so we, sometimes you're like, I don't know how much the audience is gonna laugh. Like, what do you think is funny with him reacting and people screaming and stuff? Like, I know Jabu, the little kid, has got some good fodder. The when Fang is mad at Spear, has got some good stuff there. So yeah, but
So
definitely,
many of the cuts back to Spear 2 when he's just staring wide-eyed with his mouth agape. Like there were so many good just cuts back to him where I just can't help but laugh.
oh, that's great. Yeah, like that stuff I'm not I'm never sure about, if how much humor there really is. The whole idea of a naked zombie caveman walking through the jungle naked, I thought was really funny and very just weird. So
That's awesome. Now, do you have any rules for things that you can't do in the Primal Universe? Like, obviously, there's supernatural elements at play with various cults and whatnot. But is there anything that you feel like would take the show too far in the wrong direction? Like, were there ever any ideas you had that just didn't pan out because you're like, no, it doesn't really fit in this universe?
Well, there was a couple. There was for sure in the first season, I had a he comes upon an alien spaceship idea, like an old spaceship that crashed,
Yeah.
and there's some creature that's still alive, and that felt wrong. Like it felt like everything we did had a connection to history, even though we've, abused it
Right.
and take advantage of it, but it still has historical, some sort of mythical or historical reality.
Yeah.
And I felt like that's the one rule that we followed for the most part, right? And an alien always felt like a jump the shark type of a thing.
Yeah.
And then there was that. What else did we stay away from? Oh, even like, when we did that Primal Theory, the fifth episode of the second season,
Yeah.
I was like, oh, are people gonna accept this? It's so different. And but then that one had so much controversy and discussion about it. I like that, right?
Yeah,
I like that
exactly.
the audience is very engaged. So we're like, well, maybe let's do another one like it, but different. So we had this giant idea about the future.
Oh.
And basically we flipped it to where society are zombies.
Oh, wow.
Right? They're all not like literal zombies, but they're just following the path that's laid out for them without questioning it.
Right.
And then one person is different. And how do they fit into this society where it was very science fictiony, right? But how does this one person stand out, and what does their life look like amongst this culture of robotics, almost in a way, even though they're
Okay.
humans? And I was like, I don't know how to do that in 22 minutes
Yeah.
without it breaking our whole production schedule. And it's, then you got to come up with a whole new world and characters and voice recording. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
it's like you're developing a brand new show just for one 22-minute idea.
Yeah, I was gonna say that almost feels like it could have been like a chapter if like you did Primal as an anthology series almost.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was too big, and so we dropped it, and we had enough of episodes to just tell this story
Right.
that I didn't need a like a breaker for to catch your breath again. It felt good what we had.
Yeah. Now, you have such a good relationship with Adult Swim, and you've done so many big things under the Warner Brothers banner over the years. Are you worried about Warner Brothers being bought by Netflix and how that all that's going to work?
I try not to. Like, I mean, this is my sixth or seventh merger going back to from Hanna-Barbera days.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, you hope the people you have a relationship with are still there, because I rely a lot on those relationships. And also, like I'm a content maker. And so content is always going to be in demand. And so hopefully, they'll still like my stuff, and I'll still have my opportunities. Everything else is so above me that I have no control over. And so I just, at this point, the industry has been reshaping itself and trying to find out what it is since COVID, right?
Yeah.
And that's it. And so I have no control over it. I can just do what I do, and hopefully people will continue to do it.
Yeah. Speaking of continuing to generate, that kind of content, do you have a long view plan now for future seasons of Primal? Because like much like season two, season three kind of leaves it so that that could operate as a series finale, or it could open up new stories with Spear and Mira's daughter and Fang's family and everything. So, do you have an idea percolating for season four, or are you just kind of in a wait and see mode?
Well, I mean, for sure, I'm always wait and see to make sure it's successful,
Right.
right? And we're not in a world where where Adult Swim can go like, yeah, let's do season four, let's do it, right? They're in the same situation, and then for me, I feel like I said it at the end of the second season also. Like, I feel like this is the end, and you want to move on to the anthology idea. And my goal for Primal is I want to do it until I retire, basically.
Yeah.
And if it means two or three seasons of another idea, and then we do two or three seasons or one season of another idea, we kind of keep going, because this is the most me of anything I've ever done. And so I really like that, right? Because I get to, it's the ultimate sandbox, is I kind of get to do whatever I want the way I like to do it, right? Just
Yeah,
generally.
absolutely.
And so I'd want to try a different idea for the anthology and see if whether it's the creation, if I find a different hook or something else, but it's pulpy, it's raw, it's low dialogue, and it's visual,
Nice.
and so yeah, that's kind of my goal for it.
Yeah, I hope that we get to see more. Finally, I have an article that we're putting together at Slashfilm where we're asking animators what the hardest thing is to draw. So you've been an animator for a long time now. What's the hardest thing to draw for you?
The hardest thing to draw. I mean, dinosaurs were hard, but then you kind of get used to it, and then the more you do it, the more it was, you figure it out.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's such a general question. I think to be nowadays with the internet and everything, I think the hardest thing in drawing is to be unique.
Okay.
I know that's more of a general answer, and
Yeah.
but you can learn to draw anything just by drawing it a lot. That's what I've learned, right?
For sure.
But to be unique and to have your own point of view on your drawing and your own style that's unique to yourself, and you can go, oh, that looks like this person. Like, we all have influences, right?
Right.
And we take all our influences and spin them around and see what comes out. And now in my later years, I feel like, oh, here's my style actually coming out, right? Whatever that was. And you want it to be unique to itself. And because of the internet, you have so much influences, it's almost like it waters it down. So,
Right.
right. And we didn't have that, like, hunting for comics and sci-fi magazines and watching animation, you have less influences, and so it somehow helps you be more unique.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if that makes sense,
Yeah,
but yeah,
absolutely.
so I think that's, it's being harder and harder to be an individual with a unique style that nobody else has.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. Well, they gave me the light. Thank you so much, Gendy. It was so great to talk to you. You're one of my animation heroes. I grew up on Dexter's Lab and Samurai Jack, so like it was great to talk to you. Take
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
it easy.
With me now is Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
BJ, once again, it's that time of year. It's time for you to sing the praises of Hazbin Hotel. And I use the phrase sing the praises very specifically there because you had a chance to speak with one of the people behind the music of the show.
Yeah, so I mean, folks who listen to Slashfilm Weekly know that I love adult animation. I love musicals. I love the devil. And so, Hazbin Hotel is absolutely everything that I could have ever wanted. And yeah, we had a chance to chat with Sam Haft, who is one of the composers, along with Andrew Underberg, for the original music of Hazbin Hotel. And oh my God, like, okay. I know that you've not seen Hazbin Hotel, but I do highly recommend if you have the chance to at least listen to the music. It is available and it's, Billboard charting. It's very popular music.
Oh, wow.
I know so many people who have gotten into the show because they've gotten addicted to the music.
Okay, man. Yeah, that's really cool. So, how would you describe the music in, what is it, season two now compared to season one?
Yeah, so the best thing about it is so Hazbin Hotel's voice cast is just flooded with so many Broadway greats. So you have some of the best vocalists currently alive right now providing their voices to what is ultimately, on paper, kind of like a silly premise for a show. But the music in season two very much picks up where season one left off, but things get a little bit bigger. One of my favorite songs this season is called Gravity. And it is performed by Jessica Vosk, who was, you know, one of the Broadway Elphabas in Wicked. So if you know the music of Wicked and you know what is vocally demanded of people who play Elphaba, then you know she is going to sing her face off in this season. There's just so much fun music in here. They also had the chance in season two to write for Patrick Stump of Fall Out Boy fame, who voices Abel, as in like Cain and Abel. He has a voice in here, but all of the music across the board on this show from season one and season two, it's just phenomenal. It's some of the best original music that's currently coming out today. And it's wild to me that it is hidden in this, you know, animated show on Prime Video.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I think, is the entire season available on Prime Video right now?
Yeah. So all of season two is currently available. They are, you know, working right now on season three. I can only imagine what kind of music they're going to come up with that. There's going to be, I don't know if she's going to appear in season three or season four. I mean, it's kind of hinted at, but the character of Lilith is finally going to be making an appearance. She's very much a mysterious character. We don't know who's going to voice her yet. I did an interview with the show creator Vivian Medrano towards the start of season two, where we talked about like what people should expect. And there is an article up on Slash Film where Vivian kind of teases, you know, where people should be looking in trying to figure out who's going to voice Lilith. So whoever that ends up being, I cannot wait to hear the kind of music that Sam and Andrew have written for her.
Very cool. All right. Well, here is BJ's conversation with Sam Haft.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, BJ.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Very, very excited to talk to you. Congratulations on yet another very successful season of Hazbin Hotel. Very excited to talk to you about the music, because that is the thing that just haunts my playlists, even after I've watched all of the episodes.
Well, good. And so happy to be green hair to green hair today.
Oh, yeah. Green team. Living the dream.
Yeah.
So I spoke with Vivian ahead of the premiere of season two's debut, and we talked about how with the length of animated productions, there's no real way to take into consideration audience feedback. But folks obviously responded to the music of season one in a very, very big way. So knowing what you already had coming down the pipeline for season two, did that give you a greater sense of excitement of how people might respond to the new music that you had written? Or did that add an extra layer of anxiety of knowing how high you had set the bar with season one?
I would say it was more the latter. I mean, I was certainly very excited for people to get a listen to all these songs. But also, like, we did set a very high bar in terms of, like, the way the soundtrack was received and the way the soundtrack performed. And I think with anyone's sophomore outing, I think there's always this pressure to like prove that you weren't a fluke. And I think that was a big thing that was in my head with the soundtrack coming out. And thankfully, we're not. It's great. It was great. And I was worried over nothing. But like, I feel like I'm a naturally anxious person. So I'm always prone to being like, oh, I hope this wasn't just like a one-time lightning in a bottle thing. But like, clearly, I mean, I knew going into season two that I liked season two more than season one. So I was feeling confident that the show had improved, that we had improved as songwriters. But you still, like, you never know how something's going to be received by an audience. Once it's in public, it's out of your hands.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are a handful of standouts this season, as is the case with, you know, any soundtrack that is ever written. But the big one for me especially was Gravity, because I'm a belt singer. I love a good belt number. But I also loved that we now have two different songs with Jessica Vosk singing about Gravity. And
100%.
The fact that this comes out the same year as, you know, another Wicked movie was just beautiful, beautiful kismet. And I asked Vivian about this song, and she fully blames you and said this was all your doing, of you putting 100%. This funny little Easter egg in there. So I want to know the story behind that.
Well, we were going into season two's Writers' Summit knowing that we really wanted to advocate for a big Lute villain number. And once you know, once everyone got on the same page, I mean, we didn't have to fight for it. We were like, Loot should have a big villain song. And everyone was like, yeah, we were also thinking Loot should have a big villain song. and we came into it ready to like throw hands. But everyone was like, yes, obviously this needs to happen. And also, Jessica made such an impact in season one and has like maybe 11 words she sings in season one in the song You Didn't Know. But that little bit, the like, what are you even talking about? Like, people attach themselves so much to that tiny little clip of that song that we knew that like once we unleashed the Vosk, we would get some pretty great results. And also, like, Jessica Vosk is, I feel like everyone's got their favorite Elphabas, and Jessica Vosk is mine and many people's favorite Elphaba. And so having that little meta title joke was definitely our idea. And it was something that, in fact, I think we may have had the title of the song before we even had the chorus of the song. Just like the meta joke was part of our mental headspace from the very beginning on that song.
That doesn't surprise me at all, because you are a bit of a rapscallion. I feel like you're not going to be offended by me saying that at all.
No, I've been known to be a rapscallion and a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, so there's all these like little tiny moments that I think fans obviously grab onto and hyperanalyze and dissect, and they've been doing that for the past two seasons. And so obviously the music comes before you recognize that that is going to be a thing. And now looking much further down the line, are you going to let that impact you or Andrew in the way that you craft new songs, or is it just gotta stay out of sight, out of mind?
Yeah, not really. I think part of it is it's almost like we don't have the mental bandwidth to think about the audience, because we spend so much time in the songwriting process thinking about Vivian as our audience. So we're writing for an audience, but it's an audience of one. And I think ultimately we just kind of, there are certainly moments where we like may advocate for one thing or another thing and like really push like, hey, we really believe that this is the right creative choice to go with here in the song. But like ultimately it's a very Viv driven process. This show is like the manifestation of her tastes and influences in her head, just like vomited out into the universe. So like it's so, our goal as songwriters is to reflect what's in Viv's mind and soul much more than it is to just be like, oh, I wonder if the fans are going to love this or that. Because I think, you know, Viv has really proven if you are true to the show that you want to see, that will find its audience, rather than if you're trying to shadow box like, oh, are they going to like this? Are they not going to like this? I feel like it is an insecure ground to stand on when you're making art.
I agree with you completely. And I feel like Hazbin Hotel is one of these like algorithm proof shows.
Totally.
And that it's going to attract the audience that it attracts. And it doesn't really concern itself with anybody who might be outside of that audience, which I think is a good thing.
Absolutely.
And I think that is also something that is reflected in not just your work as a songwriter on Hazbin Hotel, but also through your work with Yoav in The Living Tombstone, where you exist in this fascinating intersection as a musician, where you're part of these massively huge and popular fandoms, groups that are super passionate and very dedicated, but they're still viewed by the greater entertainment sphere as niche. And so what do you think folks who perhaps can't or won't engage with these types of projects, what are they missing out on?
I mean, I think they're missing out on original IP. Like, really, that's what it is it's not a coincidence to me that, like, two of the biggest, like, licensing and merch properties of the last, you know, like, decade or so are Hazbin Hotel and Five Nights at Freddy's, because these are two things that are like auteur driven. They're odd and they're unashamed of being odd. And there are people who have a real hunger for something that feels authentically like, you know, left of center. And I think that is really a big driver of this, is that niche isn't niche anymore. You know, like there's no such thing as really four quadrant. There's very little like you know, people, I used to see a lot of people complaining about like the monoculture like 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that idea is fundamentally dead. Like algorithms destroyed the monoculture. Everyone is in their own little fishbowl. And so your whole goal, if you want to have like a successful to be niche, you want the super fans, you want to have this group of people that feels like they have community in your property, and you want to just grow your fishbowl as much as you can. But I think if you try to, it's what I just said, if you try to like be this broad thing that everyone loves, you're going to appeal to nobody. You have to be specialized, or the thing you're making just isn't going to be served to people anymore, which is this whole weird landscape that I feel like people haven't really caught up to yet.
Oh God, I agree wholeheartedly. And I admittedly asked you this question because I knew that you were going to have a fantastic answer that I agree with and wanted that more than anything.
Well, it's so funny because I think when we talked about this on season one, we were talking about the like an entertainment industry that was so driven by this like drive for monoculture and this idea that like we need to make billion-dollar movies. And the fact is like people are in their interest buckets more than ever. And in many ways, you know, it's kind of one of the contradictions at the heart of the entertainment industry right now is that so many of the big entertainment companies are tech companies. And entertainment companies want to make art that, well, I mean, entertainment companies have in recent past been wanting to make art that appeals to a broad swath of people, and tech companies want to silo people from each other. Like there's an internal contradiction at the heart of all of these companies, because if you're a tech company, you want people in their interest bucket, and if you're an entertainment company, you want to appeal to everyone in every bucket. So we're in a fascinating part of the landscape where the interest buckets have now won in a way that they hadn't the last time you and I sat down.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's reflected even outside of projects that you're involved with. I think about, you know, everything we saw happen this year with K-pop Demon Hunters, a movie that,
oh my God, yeah,
they were like, oh, this is going to be nothing. And it's one of the biggest releases of the year. It's mind-boggling how people are not seeing these lessons being taught in real time the way that, you know, folks like you and I are. But to that note, my last question for you is that pop music in general, just the general music you hear on the radio, even though nobody really uses the radio anymore, music, like the charts are so alarming to me because we have songs that will chart for years now just because there's nothing to compete with it. So I want to know from you, what new music excites you and makes you feel, you know, inspired even?
For me, I have to say, like, it's musicals. Like, that is the thing that I feel like the stuff that is coming out and being made right now, it's show tunes, it's soundtracks. Like, that is the stuff that's getting me really, really excited. I was just last night, maybe it was the night before, I was at the Society of Composers and Lyricists in L.A. has a holiday party. And I was there for the dinner, and I had an opportunity to like sit down and just like catch up and chit chat with Emily Bear of Barlow and Bear. And I want to make sure I get his name right because I only just met him and I'm super bad at names. Mark Sonnenblick, who co-wrote the songs for K-pop Demon Hunters. And we had this moment where we just took a second of like gratitude to really appreciate this this place that we're in the music industry, where soundtracks are more meaningful now than they have been in a really long time. 2 weeks ago was the very first time that there were 3 soundtracks in the Billboard 200 ever in history. In many ways, as the interest buckets become a dominant way that entertainment is organized, theater kids are an interest bucket that is proving to be like really dominant, and is so like it's an interest bucket that is so pro music and pro new compositions and new ideas, and there's so much passion in that scene, and it's so amazing to see musicals and the love of musicals be so non-localized, because there's always been this discourse in musical theater of, like, is Broadway exclusionary? Is it so expensive and too hard to be involved with and interested in musicals? And now, I mean, musicals are taking over, and it's so exciting to see. So I had this moment with Mark and with Emily just being like, isn't this so exciting that, like, this thing that we're doing that, like, was this theater kid geeky niche is, like, not as niche as it once was. And the people, or at least, you know, this bucket of people is so excited to hear more fresh new musicals. And also, like, the stuff on Broadway, the new stuff on Broadway is fabulous of the last couple years. I mean, obviously, Hadestown is amazing, but Death Becomes Her is incredible. Maybe Happy Ending, a piece of non-adapted IP, phenomenal. There's so much great stuff happening in theater right now. And so that's the stuff in music that has me really, really excited.
Amazing. Well, obviously, preaching to the choir, as is typically the case when you and I talk to one another. But that is my time with you today. Thank you so much for chatting with me. Again, congratulations on an amazing
second season.
Can't wait to see what else you got cooking.
Oh, I can't wait for you to hear.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. You can find more about many of the things we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com and linked in the show notes for this episode. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popculture to hear from many of the folks that you heard on this episode. We're doing the full big top 50 movie moments of the year debate over there. We don't have the same time constraints that we have on this podcast. So if you would like to hear that, the first episode of that, the first part of what is going to be a three-part breakdown of that conversation is going to be available for free. And then you'll have to subscribe at patreon.com/popculture to hear parts 2 and 3 of that conversation. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. If you haven't done that yet, please take a minute and do it. I would really appreciate that. It helps us get in front of new listeners, which is crucial to keeping this show alive. And tell your friends about the show. That's another great way to help us out. If you know somebody who loves movie and TV stuff, who might get a kick out of these conversations or any of the interviews or anything, pass them a link to these episodes. We would really appreciate that. All right. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.